I'm Steve Norman reporting. Planned summit in Singapore between the U.S. and North Korean leaders is off for now. That story from VOA's Steve Miller.
U.S. President Donald Trump said that based on recent statements by North Korea, he has decided to call off his planned June 12th summit with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un.
I believe that this is a tremendous setback for North Korea and indeed a setback for the world.
While President Trump said at this point the talks are off, he also left open the possibility they could eventually take place.
It's possible that the existing summit could take place or a summit at some later date.
Steve Miller, VOA News.
Here in Washington, Republican and Democratic lawmakers gathered in classified briefings about the origins of the FBI investigation into Russia's meddling in the 2016 presidential election. Democratic Representative Adam Schiff.
Today's Gang of Eight briefing was conducted to ensure protection of sources and methods. Nothing we heard today has changed our view that there is no evidence to support any allegation that the FBI or any intelligence agency placed a spy in the Trump campaign or otherwise failed to follow appropriate procedures and protocols.
Investigators looking into the shooting down of a Malaysian Airlines flight over Ukraine 4 years ago have identified the Russian military brigade that believed to have owned the missile used to bring down the plane. It is the first time that they have suggested Russian involvement. 283 passengers, 15 crew were killed. This is VOA News. U.S. military says it has struck a major insurgent command and control mode with ground-based rocket artillery in Afghanistan's southern Helmand province. U.S. Marine Corps Brigadier General Benjamin Watson said such strikes not only degrade Taliban operations but also give Afghan partners the ability to maintain continuous pressure against a weakened enemy. U.S. deployed the military mission to Helmand in April 2017 to train, advise, and assist the regional Afghan army and police forces battling the Taliban. A retired U.S. Navy SEAL has been awarded the nation's highest military decoration for a mission in Afghanistan 16 years ago, AP's Sagar Magani reporting. From the White House.
In the war's early days, Master Chief Special Warfare Operator Britt Slabinski led an assault and rescue mission, charging up a snowy mountaintop known as Robert's Ridge after a fellow service member was thrown from their helicopter under enemy fire.
Britt continued to engage the enemy, repeatedly exposing himself to horrendous fire.
In awarding him the Medal of Honor, President Trump says Slabinski helped stabilize the wounded and kept fighting more heavily armed al-Qaeda forces until help arrived.
We thank God for making you a United States SEAL.
Sagar Magani at the White House.
UN Refugee Agency expressing alarm at what it says are significant increases in the number of people fleeing violence and persecution in Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador. The UNHCR spokeswoman, Adekarini Katiti, said there are many vulnerable women and children.
We hear repeatedly from people requesting refugee protection, including from a growing number of children, that they are fleeing forced recruitment into armed criminal gangs and death threats. As people journey across borders and onwards, they face numerous dangers, including violence at the hands of criminal groups, often leaving women in particular vulnerable to sexual abuse and exploitation.
UNHCR says the vast majority of the asylum seekers have fled to Belize, Mexico, and the United States, and increasingly to Costa Rica, Panama, in search of refugee protection. UN Security Council has unanimously approved a resolution that for the first time recognizes the link between conflict and hunger and strongly condemns the use of starvation as a method of war. UN World Food Program reported in March between 108 million and 124 million people in conflict situations suffer from severe malnutrition. Get more at voanews.com. I'm Steve Norman in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa. From the Voice of America, I'm James Botte in Washington. Today is Friday, May 25th. And here are some of the stories we are covering. It is African Liberation Day today, Friday.
We are now 55 years since the creation of OAU. The progress has been very slow. But now, more and more African leaders are realizing the importance of unity.
Arikana Chiombori-Akwa is the African Union ambassador to the United States. There are calls for punitive actions against violators of South Sudan peace. Burundi's opposition parties filed a complaint in court against the results of the just-concluded referendum. And flood deaths surpass 400 across East Africa.
I believe right now we're looking at about 220,000 people who are temporarily displaced due to the flood waters. Until those recede, those people will remain displaced and in need of humanitarian assistance.
Justin Brady is head of the UN Office of Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. Ugandan police seek end to 48-hour rule and what's fueling insecurity in Burkina Faso. Those stories, plus Samson O'Malley's sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The African Union is today, Friday, marking the 55th anniversary of African Liberation Day. A key aim of what was known then as the Organization of African Unity, or OAU, was to push for the independence of a large number of countries that were still under colonial rule. Today, 54 countries are sovereign states. Ambassadors and other dignitaries are gathering in Washington, D.C. today to celebrate African Day. Arikana Chiombori Wow is the African Union ambassador to the United States. She tells reporter Jonga Kandimiri of VOA Zimbabwe service that Africa is still struggling to reach its full potential due to colonialism.
I think we have a long way to go, which is why the African Union is committed to implementing these regional and continental programs to encourage integration. Some of the economies are very small. They clearly cannot survive on their own. And remember, the reason these countries were divided up in 1885 during the Berlin Conference, it was all designed to make sure that the African countries and the continent itself are defeated and dominated people. So you'll find that the more powerful the kingdom was, the more countries that came out of it. So the countries of Africa that we see today, they were a design of the colonial masters to make sure that we don't survive on our own, and that we'll continue to need them.
The African Union was formed to promote unity and solidarity among African states. Is this happening?
We are slowly getting there. The progress has been very slow. We are now 55 years since the creation of OAU, but now more and more African leaders are realizing the importance of unity. But keep in mind, we also have to deal with issues of my problems from outside. We have corruption in Africa, yes, we understand, and we must deal with that corruption. But I can tell you, the larger corruption for Africa, which is the bigger problem, is the corruption from outside, from those with money, who use their money to keep Africa in a turmoil. So the corruption from inside and the corruption from outside, they must equally and aggressively be addressed in order for Africa to truly move forward.
Some analysts are saying that the exploitation of African resources still continues, even though there is this African Union, which should also serve as a guard against all these exploitations. What can you say about this?
What I can tell you is African Union as a body does not have sovereignty. Individual countries have sovereignty. So decisions are made at the African Union, but at the end of the day, implementation is by the sovereign nation. And yes, at the AU level, we're talking about value addition to our goods. As Africa, to our natural resources. As Africa, we are busy creating jobs for the rest of the world except Africa. So yes, on the top of our agenda as well is value addition to all our natural resources. And it is work in progress, and it is progressing very fast.
Arikana Chiombori Kwao is the African Union ambassador to the United States. She was speaking with reporter Jonga Kandimiri of VOA Zimbabwe service. A coalition of Burundian opposition parties has filed a complaint in the country's constitutional court against the results of the just-concluded referendum. The move comes 3 days after the country's independent electoral commission announced that more than 75% of Burundians voted to amend the constitution and probably keep President Pierre Nkurunziza in power until 2034. Moses Havyarimana reports.
The Burundi political party coalition Amizero ya Burundi, which literally means the trust of Burundians, deposited a complaint at the country's constitutional court, calling on the court to annul the results. The Burundi Independent Electoral Commission on Monday announced that 73% of the registered 4.8 million voters voted to amend the country's constitution. Agathon Rwasa, the leader of the opposition coalition, said that the referendum was not free and fair, and that most of the opposition members were intimidated, with others ending up in jail.
It is a process which is coming when people are upset by the governance of the current regime, because it comes to refrain the space for everybody. It comes to withdraw the rights of the parliament, the rights of the people.
According to the Burundian Electoral Code, a political party or independent candidate has 3 days to submit any complaint to the Constitutional Court after the results of an election have been announced by the Electoral Commission. The court has 7 days to announce the verdict, but observers say the chances are pretty slim for opposition to win the case. After all, the Electoral Commission, Home Affairs Minister, Ombudsman and majority of the political parties have declared that the elections were free and fair. Prosper Nahoramie is the spokesman of the Electoral Commission. He says the Electoral Commission has already declared that the process went smoothly and well, despite some minor problems, but that the opposition coalition have the right to go to court. More than 20 political parties participated in the two-week campaign for or against the amendment of the country's constitution. But only the opposition coalition Amizero ya Burundi campaigned against the constitutional change. Evariste Ndayishimiye is the secretary general of the Burundi's ruling party, CNDD-FDD. He says that the date of 17th May will go down in the history of Burundi as an important date to all Burundians, and that they played a part in deciding their future that will impact generations to come. He said that the victory is not only for the ruling party supporters or specific political group, but a victory for all Burundians. In less than 5 years, the opposition resorted to the constitutional court to clear the disputes. The last time was in 2015, when the opposition asked the court for interpretation of the constitution whether President Pierre Nkurunziza was eligible to run another term in the office. Moses Havyarimana, VOA Africa, Bujumbura.
The United States, Britain, and Norway are calling on the regional bloc, the Intergovernmental Authority on Development, also known as IGAD, to institute punitive measures against violators of the peace process in South Sudan. The move comes a day after peace talks ended in the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa, without an agreement. Wake Simon Wudu reports from Addis Ababa.
Ambassadors from the three countries say they appreciate efforts by the warring parties to engage in talks aimed at ending the conflict, but they have not shown the political will to reach a deal. Brian Suken is the director in the office of the U.S. Special Envoy for Sudan and South Sudan.
We have taken an approach using sanctions where we can to apply pressure and also to hold people accountable.
Suken says the Troika countries are also disturbed to hear that fighting continues in former unity state despite a stated recommitment by the warring parties on Tuesday to fully implement the cessation of hostilities agreement signed last December. Suken urges the warring parties to fully implement the ceasefire. He says it's only when the guns are silent that the U.S. will believe the warring parties are committed to ending the conflict.
First and foremost, the violence must stop. While we recognize the recommitment of the parties to the December cessation of hostilities agreement, what matters is implementation. That requires two things. The cessation of hostilities must be respected by the parties, and it must be enforced.
Christopher Thrott, the United Kingdom's special envoy for Sudan and South Sudan, agrees.
Please take action against the people who are violating the peace process, against people who are not fully committed to this process, against people who are spoiling this process.
Trott says it's time for the South Sudanese leaders to realize there is urgent need to end the conflict.
We are in the process of looking at ways in which we can introduce sanctions on individuals, both for corrupt practices and for obstructing the peace process.
Trott did not specify what kind of sanctions the Troika wants to impose on spoilers of the peace process, but he says the Troika is ready to use tools available in the UN Security Council's toolbox to punish violators of the cessation of hostilities agreement. When the South Sudan High-Level Revitalization Forum resumed in Addis Ababa last week, the African Union warned it would punish parties and individuals obstructing peace in South Sudan. Kwati did not outline what type of punitive measures the African Union intends to take against those who block the peace process. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Botte in Washington. Today is Friday, May 25th. Please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is now 16 minutes past the hour. Heavy rains have left hundreds of people dead and hundreds of thousands more displaced across various parts of East Africa. Kenya, Somalia, and Rwanda are the worst hit. The flooding comes as the region tries to recover from a severe drought in 2017 that threatened millions of people. Rael Ombuo reports from Nairobi.
Across Kenya, Rwanda, and Somalia, the death toll from the flooding has surpassed 400, with many thousands more forced to flee their homes to escape rising waters. Rwanda's Ministry of Disaster Management puts its death toll at just over 200 in a period of 4 months. The number includes 18 killed this month as a result of landslide triggered by heavy rains. In Somalia, the Juba and Shabelle rivers have burst their banks. Justin Brady is the head of the UN Office of Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs in Somalia. He says the situation has left those affected by the flooding vulnerable to malnutrition and disease.
We've had a number of deaths reported at different junctures in the flooding. I believe right now we're looking at about 220,000 people who are temporarily displaced due to the flood waters. Until those recede, those people will remain displaced and in need of humanitarian assistance. We may see that number climb up in the short term with flooding spreading downstream as the waters move toward the Indian Ocean.
Earlier in the week, at least 15 people died in Somaliland when heavy rains caused by tropical cyclone Sagar swept through the Horn of Africa. The cyclone system has caused heavy rains in both the Puntland and Somaliland regions of Somalia and moved along the coast to Djibouti. Brady says those areas were especially hard hit by drought the last 3 years.
So you already had a very low level of resilience of the population. There are several districts that were most affected. The government is continuing to refine the number of people in need. And initially, it was around 670,000. That number has come down, as I understand it, but it's a case of being able to get into areas.
In Kenya, the Red Cross says at least 200 people have died as a result of the heavy rains. In the biggest catastrophe, a dam burst last week on a commercial farm in the Rift Valley, killing at least 48. Emergency appeals have been launched by the affected governments and NGOs for humanitarian assistance. Rael Ombuo, VOA News, Nairobi.
Increased attacks from Islamist groups in Burkina Faso and abuses by security forces in retaliation for these attacks are fueling insecurity and an environment of fear in the country, according to a report this week by Human Rights Watch. Corinne Dufka is the Sahel director for Human Rights Watch.
Since that time, there have been terrible crimes committed by both the armed Islamist groups as well as the security forces as they have responded to the presence of these groups. Now, these abuses include extrajudicial killings by the army as well as arbitrary detentions and some very serious cases of mistreatment. And then on the other side, the Islamists have attacked purely civilian targets in Ouagadougou twice as well as killed numerous state representatives or those they suspect of providing intelligence to the army. Human Rights Watch documented 19 of these executions. They targeted village chiefs and village councillors. Also, the Islamists have attacked the education sector.
According to your report, you've documented many schools have been out of session. Is that correct? Can you elaborate on that?
Yes. From early 2017, the Islamists attacked numerous schools, and they killed a popular school director. They rocked up at numerous schools and threatened the teachers not to teach in English. They burned schools and school materials and so on. And this created absolute panic in the north and led to the flight of hundreds of teachers and the closure of over 200 schools. So it's left over 20,000 children out of school.
A lot of these attacks have happened in northern Burkina Faso. There's not really anywhere else for these people to go. I would guess that the surrounding regions in neighboring Mali, and I'm not sure about Niger, are also, you know, Islamist hotspots.
Yes, there have been, the insecurity has provoked the displacement of at least 12,000 people. Many of them have come to Ouagadougou or elsewhere in Burkina, but interestingly and disturbingly, some of them have fled to Mali, and even with its insecurity, that Mali seems like a safer place is really, you know, a reflection of how insecure they feel in their villages in northern Burkina Faso.
The poor community often feels the backlash when things like these happen because they are oftentimes, when it comes down to it, seen as foreigners in many of these countries in the Sahel and West Africa. So is there a concern that this will, A, marginalize them more and thus, B, radicalize some people as well?
Since at least 2012, the armed Islamist groups have concentrated their recruitment efforts on the Pul or Fulani, who live in Mali, Burkina Faso, Niger, and numerous other countries in Africa. They have made a concerted effort to recruit members from this community. We have found that a heavy-handed response by the armed forces only serves to encourage members of some members of the Pul community to join the armed Islamist groups. And, you know, the armed Islamists are well aware that they're very adept at exploiting local grievances and problems in the interest of recruiting members of this community.
That was Corinne Dufka, Sahel Director for Human Rights Watch. She was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Washington, D.C. The Ugandan police force is facing stiff resistance over a proposal that would allow officers to hold suspects beyond the maximum of 2 days before the accused are granted bail or make a court appearance. Halima Atumani reports from Kampala.
Police say certain crimes such as terrorism require cross-border investigations to acquire evidence and witnesses. Authorities are seeking support from Parliament to amend Article 23 of the Constitution so that police can hold terrorism suspects for 7 to 14 days before producing them in court. Patrick Onyango is the deputy spokesperson of the Uganda Police.
Sometimes analyzing these samples we pick from the scenes of crime also need time, because for us we also use another government analytical laboratory. They also need time, and sometimes they say we are overwhelmed, the one with the samples you bring to us. So we are requesting members of parliament that there are certain cases they need to amend the constitution to allow us keep suspect for at least more than 48 hours.
Before the proposal can advance, it must receive support from the Parliamentary Human Rights Committee. Jova Kamateka, who chairs the committee, says she is skeptical. She says police are already flouting the rule.
They have failed to honor the rule in small cases. And we think that even the rule as it stands now, you can take a suspect to court and say you are not ready and ask for extension. Secondly, our police cells, we don't have that much space to hold these people.
Last year, as police investigated the murder of Felix Kawesi, the former Assistant Inspector General Police, suspects spent more than 5 months behind bars without appearing in court. Several other suspects, including opponents of President Yoweri Museveni, have also been held in police custody for more than 48 hours before appearing in court or being granted bail. The Uganda Human Rights Commission, a government body, has continuously faulted the police for ignoring the rule. The chairperson of the commission, Medi Mulumba, says any effort to thwart terrorism should uphold fundamental principles of human rights.
Yes, we abhor terrorists, we abhor violent crimes, but we are saying police should be facilitated, should be trained, should use scientific methods of investigations. What is it that they want to do in the police cell without scrutiny of the public that they cannot do in a prison? Because all we are trying to say, arrest this person in 48 hours, take this person to court, this person is remanded.
The police maintain that as long as investigations are ongoing, suspects in what they consider sensitive cases will stay in custody to prevent new crimes from being committed. Halima Athmani for VA News, Kampala.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you, James. We begin in Zambia, where the head coach of the Zambian national soccer team, Wetsin Yirenda, has resigned from his position. The general secretary of the country's soccer governing body, Ponga Liwewe, who announced the resignation on Thursday, said the process to fill the vacancy will begin soon and that the association will conclude the process in the shortest possible time to meet upcoming engagements. Yirenda served as national soccer team coach from September 2016 to May 2018. And now to Ghana, where Kwesi Inyatachi, head of the Ghana Football Association and a member of the FIFA Council, has been arrested and detained after a complaint from the president of Ghana, Nana Akufo-Addo. Inyatachi is the second CAF delegate on FIFA Council to run into domestic difficulties in the past 6 weeks after Constant Omari Selemani in DR Congo. A spokesman for Akufo-Addo's office told local media that Inyatachi has been recorded using the name of the president and other senior government officials to try to persuade potential investors to part with money.
The president, as a responsible citizen, has had to consult and evaluate the content of this investigative piece. The president, after these consultations, is fully satisfied that a prima facie basis has been established for criminal investigations to be launched into the conduct of the president of the Ghana Football Association, Mr. Kwesi Inyatachi.
And now to the preparations for the Super Eagles ahead of the 2018 FIFA World Cup in Russia. Chelsea right wing-back Victor Moses will not train with the Super Eagles on Nigerian soil before the 2018 World Cup in Russia. The Nigerian Football Federation tweeted that the Blues' number 15 will join the team in London ahead of the friendly with England on June the 2nd. And staying with the Super Eagles preparation, Leicester City midfielder Wilfred Ndidi has recovered faster than expected from a hamstring injury and will soon join Nigeria's full World Cup training. Meanwhile, coach Garrett Rao says the Super Eagles will need mental toughness to defend and attack as a team when they face their opponents when the World Cup begins in Russia next month.
We have a team who must win together playing a collective football, because not one person, even not Obi Mikel, can make us winning alone. So this is the first thing we decided, to have a collective. Everybody is attacking when we have the ball. Everybody has to defend when we don't have the ball.
And to another World Cup bound team, Morocco. A friendly match between the national football teams of Morocco and Ukraine will be held in Switzerland on May 31st. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good weekend. And that's it for this Friday, May 25th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you a very good weekend.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning in to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa,
Is it the dawn of a new era in Ethiopian politics? Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed is promising to strengthen democratic reforms and promote unity in the East African nation. Moving forward in Ethiopia on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.